Bill Lishman taught himself to fly, then became the first human to fly in formation with birds. He also became the first person to lead a flock of birds on a migration. This pioneering work led to the restoration of a migratory flock of highly endangered whooping cranes that now summer in Wisconsin and winter in Florida. Story was the inspiration for the 1996 film Fly Away Home and the French feature film The Winged Migration. Bill will present We Owe It to the Birds, about how the air adventure in nature started 400 million years ago and continues to be an inspiration today for humans to fly. Bill ends his talk describing his new initiative, Air First Aid, using weight shift aircraft in disaster relief. Please welcome Bill Lishman.
Well, listening to Denny and listening to Tom, boy, passion is what it's about, and following your dreams. And that's what I want to talk about here tonight, because, you know, I followed my dream, and I want to tell you a little bit about it. I'm 70 years old this year, and I was born before World War II started, and all of the fighter pilots of World War II that really inspired me, and a few other things like that. But birds in general, because I used to watch my father's plowing the field with the seagulls behind them, and I said, "How do they do that? How do they fly like that?" So I have a few images. I like to show more than tell, because. Well, let me backtrack a little bit and talk about what happened to me when I was I started school in 1945, and I went to a little one-room schoolhouse. And I'm going to turn on this, and I can show you a couple of pictures as we go. As I say, the Great Air Adventure started over 400 million years ago, and if you look at the dragonfly, for example. It's been flying for 400 million years. And unbelievable. All of us have watched dragonflies and realized that those are unbelievable flyers. Birds have been flying for 120 million years. And I like to say that since we could perceive, as we evolved, as we humans evolved and could perceive of birds, they have really inspired us. Because here we were plodding along on the ground, and they had that three-dimensional freedom. And it took us how long? And we've only been flying for a little over 100 years. Let me show you a couple things here. I was down in Antarctica, and actually in South Georgia, and that's the home of the wandering albatross, the bird with the largest wingspan in the world. It's 11-foot wingspan, and it's an amazing bird. It's 11 months old before it can get airborne, and on its first flight, it doesn't land back on land for a year. It flies around the world. The wind down there is so strong, it keeps on going and until it gets back. And there, so here's its first landing after being at sea for a year. It lands on the sea, mind you, but it doesn't land back on land for over a year. So I had a great time filming these birds coming in, and watch this character. He does a little bit of a nose plant, but not bad. And then sitting next to me was another bird down there, which was quite amazing. I forgot about this little scene here. As afterwards, you know, the pilots get together and have a little chat and trying to impress the local chicks. And chick it is. They do get into quite a boasting thing, you know, about how they've been here and there, and one usually outboasts the other and drives them off. And but the girl obviously said, "Well, I don't want to have anything to do with that." and then there was this wonderful bird. This is called I can't think of the name at the moment. Giant petrel. It has about 8-foot wingspan, and they have a hard time taking off. Now look at this. He says, "Well, I need a little bit more runway." And sits there and he looks around. Well, the most useless thing is the runway behind you. And says, "Have I got enough yet?" Well, I'm not sure. Well, again, I better use it all. and he goes right back to the threshold. And then, of course, he's a little bit nervous. Everybody's watching, and he warms it up a little bit, shakes off a little nervousness. We've all done that. And then, well, I got to go. We have so much to learn from these birds. Just sitting there that one day I spent on this island watching these giant albatross and the giant petrel, was fantastic. But to go back to what I was talking about, I love flying with. I was raised on a small farm, you know, and my parents, my mother a biologist and my father an amateur biologist, were really involved in animal behavior and how to improve things. And I went to a one-room schoolhouse in 1945, I said, and I had difficulty because I couldn't learn to read. Now, that's me, the third in from the, I'm also dyslexic, third in from the right. Anyway, third in from the right in the back row. But I had a very difficult time learning to read because I am dyslexic. And of course, the word wasn't even invented in 1945. The teacher told my parents, I'm a slow learner. And I guess, she was right at the time, and so I failed grade one. But I graduated out of that school, top of my class. Mind you, there was only two of us in the class, and the other guy didn't even speak English. So, but my desire was to learn to fly, and I joined Air Cadets. Well, I thought I'd overcome the dyslexia, and I learned to march. I marched for 3 years, and I learned about aero engines and navigation and all of this, and I had a scholarship to learn to fly. I went for my medical, and I'm colorblind. You know, so my desire is to fly one of these things, which was the aircraft of 1945. This is a two-thirds scale, but that was my big desire. Well, that went out the window. And then I went through high school, and high school was just as bad. I had such a difficult time. I wasn't an academic. My two sisters went through school and got their degrees in university, etc. But I wound up 18 years of age knowing not what to do because I had kind of failed academically, and my big desire for flying had been thrown out the window. So, but I was good at three-dimensional things. I could make things in three dimensions, and I decided to become a sculptor. And I'll just show you. So I understood animals, so I could do portraits of animals, and I did these. I kept getting commissions. People liked what I was doing, and so these are just a few of my pieces. I won't spend much time on them, but this one actually is owned by a Texas oil baron, and he'd invited me into his house when I'd. Just by happenstance, and he had a room about the size of this whole hall here as his living room, and with amazing sculptures in it, and I was intimidated. And I had a picture of this thing, and he says, "Is that for sale?" And I said, "Yeah, that's for sale." And he says, "How much?" And I scratched my head and said, "Well, $50,000." He says, "It's mine." So I got a good name for these, and it was very successful, and did quite a number of sculptures over a 40-year career, actually, and met a lovely lady and married her in 1968. She became a fashion designer, a knitter. She wanted to knit, so I designed her this rocking chair. But it was in 1968, actually, that was a major turning point in my life, because that was 40 years ago, the year of the Apollo, the year of the landing when Neil Armstrong stepped down onto the moon. And that was a great turning point for the whole world, I think. Not so much that we got to the moon. I mean, it was a fantastic achievement when you think about it. But it was that image of the planet that came back. And we saw we lived on this beautiful little blue ball and realize that we live on this little finite thing. It was really the beginning of the understanding that we do have a finite little planet and that we have to protect it. But I was so excited by this that I said, I got to do something sculpturally to commemorate this. And at the same time, we'd bought a little one-room schoolhouse, and we needed to expand on that. And I needed to build I ran afoul of the building inspector, local building inspector, and he wouldn't give me a building permit. So I said, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build, I needed a study, I needed a place to work. And I said, I'm going to build a replica of the lunar lander, and you don't need a building permit for that. And eventually, maybe I can sell it to a museum once we go through. So I built a full-scale replica of the Grumman lunar lander. Well, that was fun for a while, but it became very difficult to live with because people would knock on my door in the middle of the night saying, "Do you see what just landed in your yard?" And there were a lot of stories. If I had time, I could tell you a lot of humorous stories around this. I had it for 12 years, and you know, we'd kind of mortgaged the house to build this thing, and I thought it'd be really good to sell it. Well, that was a poor business idea too, because museums don't buy things; they like them donated, and then they give you a tax write-off. Well, Neil Armstrong's hometown in Wapakoneta, Ohio, wanted it. And they said they'd give me a tax write-off, but I was a starving Canadian artist. I couldn't use an American tax write-off, so it didn't work. But a fellow from Oklahoma City called me by the name of Clarence Page. Well, Clarence Page had started Page Aviation, which I understand became Grumman Aviation. And of course, Grumman built the lunar lander. And he was building a museum. He said, "I'd like to have that, but I can't pay you anything for it. But there's some Japanese interested in it." And the long story short, the Japanese came and had a look at it. Japanese businessmen, and they were having a big show in downtown Tokyo, and it was to commemorate the 25th anniversary of NASA. And the main artifact they had was a replica of the space shuttle. So they wanted a lunar lander, and they'd searched the world for it, and they had 6 weeks to go, and they couldn't find one because they're all on the moon except for the one I had. So I was able to, it was a very good business move in the end, and it sat there in Tokyo. And they flew my wife and I over to Tokyo for the opening of the show, and the usherettes were all dressed in space suits, and at the head table sat the Japanese royalty and the American ambassador and Paula and I and a number of people, and all these speeches were given. And when they came to talk about the lunar lander, they said, they pointed to Paula and I, and of course, as I say, the speeches were in Japanese, so we didn't understand what they were saying, but there was a big round of applause, and we did our bow and everything. And then afterwards, the American ambassador came up and started talking to me. And the Japanese reported that we had been the NASA engineers that had designed the lunar lander. So, it was Clarence Page that made the great deal on that, because he'd made a deal with the Japanese that if he'd tell them where the lunar lander is, and they could, if they get it, then at the end of it, they would donate it to the museum. So it sits today in the Oklahoma Aviation Space Hall of Fame, and if you go in there and have a look at it and ask them where it came from, I think they might tell you it came from NASA. So you know now. And while we're on the subject, by the way, Walter Cronkite, of course, was the great announcer of that. And my mother's maiden name is Cronkite. I just wanted to throw this in because Walter figured very, very largely in the last month or so. And strangely enough, in high school, one of the things I could do very well, I would do the student announcements, and I could do a Walter Cronkite very well. I would do a Walter Cronkite. What kind of a day is it? You know, I won't do it here, but anyway, I could do this Walter Cronkite. And so about 3 years ago, we had a family reunion down in Martha's Vineyard, and I went out fishing with some buddies in the Chappaquiddick, and as we were coming back, one of them said, "You know, that's Walter Cronkite's house." I says, "Oh, I should call him up and invite him to our Cronkite family reunion." And lo and behold, I get back home, back to where we're having the family reunion, and I talk to my cousin. I says, you know Walter Cronkite lives here? Yeah, she says, I called and invited him to the reunion. And lo and behold, he came. And we sat there and had a scotch, and we talked about where the family name came from, and he is a distant relative, amazingly enough. So I'm quite proud of that, and a great American icon. A couple more sculptures. I'd like to talk a little bit about Richard Van Hoeven. I'll go back one here. That was Expo 86 in Vancouver, one of the tallest sculptures. It is actually the celebration of land transportation, and on the very top is a one-legged runner, supposedly, but it isn't. It's Tina Turner, because she had the legs, you know, and it's the best land transportation we have. Richard Van Hoeven, who worked with me for the last 40 years, now flying cranes here in Wisconsin. He is a sculptor par excellence, and has worked with me making cranes. This sculpture itself, the hooping crane, is one of four that is at the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. Anybody know what that is? It's not Stonehenge, that's Ottohenge. A replica of Stonehenge and Icehenge. Actually, you know, there is a guy in Nebraska built one afterwards, but I built that in 1986. And the amazing thing, because when it was done, I stood in the middle of it and I had this unbelievable deja vu, like I had been there before. I'd never been to Stonehenge, but it gave you this tremendous feeling. And then other people told me they had that same experience when they'd go there, they'd have this powerful feeling. And it really tells you that there is a memory that comes through generation after generation of something as iconic as that. And other things in life follow through. So what happens to you today is, I'll leave it at that. This Icehenge, it didn't quite last as long as Stonehenge, about a day and a half. And ice, quite wonderful, actually. If you get a nice clear piece, you can carve a lens out of it, and then the lens can make fire. The last sculpture is called The Exhausted Man. I just left that by the freeway one day. Before we get into flying, after we moved out of that schoolhouse, we acquired another piece of property, and the house that was on it, this house, couldn't be heated very well, and I thought, well, I better design something a little more efficient. So I thought if we built underground, it might work, but most underground houses are square boxes, and that doesn't give you much feeling of life. So I got inspired by the igloo after building a few of them, the feeling of the space and light, and so I designed this house. I thought this would be a lovely underground house. Imagine going to the building inspector with those drawings. And I actually did get a building permit, and by 1990, my wife Paula had built her knitting of fur and her career into a very financially rewarding thing, and we were able to do this, take the top off the hill. That's one of her jackets. She sold many of them to Japanese people. And we took the top off the hill and constructed this wire frame and covered it with concrete. I say this very quickly, but I thought about it for about 15 years before we put it together. That was it before the dirt went back on. Give you a scale. The center dome is 24 feet in diameter, and it's about everybody says how many square feet? They're not. They're all round, but it's 2,700 round feet, square feet, and this is what it looks like inside. We've been living in it for 18 years, and it's quite wonderful. Heat, light, and space, and now everybody's saying, where can I get one? But the kitchen, it was a real creative process to design this thing, because you can't go to Home Depot or or Lowe's or anything and get anything that fits. So everything had to be handmade. And this is, in the end, it looks like this. The kitchen was the hardest to design, and I thought about the refrigerator and redesigned that at the same time because refrigerators really don't work properly. All the cold air comes out. And so this is my idea for a refrigerator, and it's worked quite well. Eventually, it might be in production. But it was birds, again, that really got me going, and I wanted to learn to fly. 1970s, people started hang gliding. And I bought a hang glider from a friend of mine that lived down the road that was building them in his backyard. And that's the only picture of it that it exists, and that's its only flight.
This is EAA Radio, AM 1210, Oshkosh, on the web at airventure.org.
The Easy Riser as a hang glider. And of course, this is 1976 when I bought the kit and built it and then went out on the hill. And of course, there were no instructors, and so the only way to learn to fly was to call up Larry Morrow in long distance in California in the house, no cell phones or anything at that time, and get instructions from him and then go out in the hill. And he says, well, you know, you get it up on your back and you point it in the wind and you run off the hill. And I did that a number of times. Fortunately, there was corn at the bottom of the hill that softened the way of landing. And after 2 years, I'd had 11 minutes of airtime. I thought there had to be a better way. And then I read about this guy, John Moody, from here in Wisconsin, who'd put a chainsaw motor on the back of his Easy Riser. Not a chainsaw motor, a go-kart motor. And I did the same thing. I got one of Chuck Lazargic's Busy Bee motors and put it on the back. And this is my very first powered flight. Finally, I get in the air after... I'm now almost 40 years old, and I'm just hanging from my armpits. I tell you, it was the scariest flight of my life. But that is a good landing. There were many that weren't. Anyway, I every time I landed it badly, I rebuilt it, and I eventually put wheels on it and a little Koenig three-cylinder radial engine, and it became the Easy Riser ultralight. So I claim to be a survivor of the evolution of the ultralight aircraft. And I show this, and you know, it was great because you could get up in the morning and power that thing up, and I could be airborne in 15 minutes and just go wandering through the countryside at 35 miles an hour. Beautiful way to see the countryside on a nice calm dawn or in the evening. And I show this next picture because it's a picture of my uncle Bill and his 100th birthday when he was in 2002. He was born the year before the Wright brothers first flew. In one man's lifetime, all of that took place. But everything happened in aviation since the Wright brothers was up to the mid-70s. Was to go faster and farther and higher, and nothing really flew under 50 miles an hour. So here I realized for the first time in history, I was flying at bird speed. And one day, and this picture just gives you a little indication, by happenstance, I got involved with a huge flock of ducks. They took off from a field that I was flying over, and I couldn't outclimb them and outfly away from them, and I went on for about 2 minutes with these birds all around me, two ducks out in front of me, looking back over their shoulder, wondering what was going to happen, and then they realized there was no problem. So I it was such an epiphany. I saw the world so differently. Here I was up with these creatures that we'd been all envious of for so long, and I was actually flying with them. I saw the world so differently that I had to do it again. And it took me 3 years to figure out how to do it. It was quite a lovely experience. I sought out a fellow by the name of Bill Carrick who had trained a flock of geese to fly with a boat. And what he did, he raised these birds from the egg and get them to follow him, imprinting. They thought of him as the father figure or the mother figure. And then he'd take them out in the middle of the lake when they learned to fly and dump them overboard and start up the boat, and away they'd go and follow him. So I thought, well, I'll start out with a motorcycle. I'll get them following me with a motorcycle. And it worked. I got them following me on the motorcycle. Actually, birds understand lift so well that one would fly right off the top of my helmet and fly off the lift off my helmet. And so away I'd go, and with this goose flying. And then I'd look back, and there'd be a V of them flying off this goose. So I'd have this V of geese flying off my helmet as I went down the highway. It was absolutely astounding to the oncoming traffic. But when it came to switching them over to fly with the aircraft was too foreign for them. They hadn't been raised with it, so that it took me two more years to figure out what to do. And eventually, my daughter, who was 5 years old at the time, and I raised a flock of geese, and I would tell her, you know, you got to put them on the ground and let them follow you. You can't just hug them like that. And she had her own thing. I'd say, put it down, Carmen, put it down. And that would be her reaction. And she's still like that. But anyway, it worked. And this is my actual very first flight with Canada geese. And it was every bit as much as lovely as I'd imagined. And so every day that summer I would go flying with these, and I was able to take, that was 1988, and I took a little camera up with me. It was the first time that cameras had got small enough so you could carry it, video cameras, and it was not high definition, but it was working toward that. That was Super VHS, and I filmed this all in Super VHS, and I got shots that nobody else had ever got before, like this one, and edited it together in a little kind of home movie, which was called "Come On Geese," and it went all around the world. Everybody that was intrigued with birds and with flying watched this movie, it would seem, and it sold through the EAA here year after year, and then I got calls. Well, I actually got a call from I'm thinking. Excuse me, I'm 70. My memory doesn't work perfectly all the time. I got a call from Terry Kohler here, who was a member of the EAA, and he said, I'd like to introduce you to George Archibald from the International Crane Foundation, because if you can do that with geese, maybe you can lead a new flock of geese on migration. And so I thought, what a wonderful challenge. And I teamed up with a fellow friend and ultralight pilot by the name of Joe Duff, and the two of us raised a flock of geese in 1993 was the first year. We didn't actually get a permit because they wouldn't give us one, but they said they wouldn't prosecute us by doing this. They thought we were playing with birds. And we flew this, we worked with these birds on a day-to-day basis and got 18 of them flying with us. And a year or so later, I'll switch on a little further. Anyway, we got this 18 flying, and we flew them across Lake Ontario and down in through Pennsylvania, New York State, Pennsylvania, and into Virginia, where I'd made arrangements with a fellow by the name of Dr. Sladen, who had a wildlife refuge there. And those geese stayed over winter there. The next spring, we thought we'd have to go down and lead them home, but they came home on their own while we were looking for them. And so it really worked. So we said, well, we've proven it works, but in science, we were artists, not scientists, so we had to do it again. So in 94, we did it again with 36 birds. We raised 36 of them and flew them the same route across Lake Ontario in the fall and down into Virginia. This time we'd figured out a far better technique, and we rented a large turf farm so we could taxi and work with them on a day-to-day basis. And one of those days when I was taxiing with them, I ran over one of them. And it was just devastating. Here was this goose lying on its back with its feet kicking, and I thought, like, it's dead. And I got up and I picked it up and kind of squished it back in shape because it was kind of bent out of shape. And anyway, it sort of walked off and with a bent head, but and a limp, and my son said, "Bill, you've created Igor." And Igor survived fine. As a matter of fact, Igor became the head honcho goose. He was the alpha goose in the flock, and every day you'd go to let him out of the pen, he would be right there talking to you, and he'd gabble away, and I'd learned a bit of goose by then and could chatter away with him, and he would be the first one airborne, and he would fly right there next to me while the rest of the geese would fly off the would wake surf. Well, Igor, here's a picture of him. There he is, up here underneath the wing. And of course, the goose in the back of the shot is just surfing off the wake of the aircraft, and so are the rest of the geese. But Igor's in down air, and he has to work hard to stay there. And as we crossed Pennsylvania, Igor went missing. We landed near Harrisburg, and there was no sign of him. And we couldn't stop and go back and get him or anything, because it was just a needle in a haystack scenario. Flew on to Virginia. And the Williamsport News ran a little story about this missing goose, and a lady from Lock Haven, the origin home of Piper, that little village there, town there. She found this goose, and she read out the number. It was Igor, and they said, "Well, we'll come and get him. We're 200 miles further down. We're down in Virginia." So she says, "Oh no, I'll take him down for you." So she puts him in a doggy kennel and drives him all the way to Virginia. And we let Igor go with the flock again. But Igor was no longer the head honcho. They'd run him off because he'd stopped being the leader. He'd dropped out, and a new leader had taken over. And it was kind of like, you know, if George Bush wanted to go back in the White House. That was the scenario. So he was accepted back in again gradually, but he was never the leader. And he went on and flew another 400 miles into South Carolina. And we landed there on the 4th of December of 1994, and we landed at this pond where there was lots of fresh water, etc. And we always try and get them near ponds because when they land, they need to splash around and drink, etc. But they wouldn't go in for some reason. And I waded out into the pond, splashed water at them. No way we could get those geese get in that pond. And it was the first time it had ever happened. 20 minutes later, an alligator surfaced. So if you wonder why there are so many Canada geese, they have a survivor instinct far beyond what I have, anyway. But anyway, about 10 days later, Igor and all of the geese went missing, the whole 36 of them that we'd taken down there. And there's a big search for them all over South Carolina. No sign of them, months go by, and then Bob Joyner, the biologist that was in charge of the area down there, he said he'd heard the story that a biker club had had Christmas dinner on a flock of Canada geese. Well, it was devastating because we'd put so much effort into this next thing, which was the final proof that we could lead birds on migration. And it was quite believable because these really were tame geese. They wanted to hang out with people, and didn't happen. We couldn't find them. So we'd given up, and by then Hollywood had got a hold of the story. ABC's 2020 had done a special on it in the fall of 1994. It showed on Thanksgiving Day, and something like 30 million people watched it. So we made a deal with Columbia Pictures to help them make Fly Away Home, the movie. And we were thinking about this, and then on the 9th of April, I got a call from a wildlife officer in Niagara Falls, New York, and he said, "There's a goose here," and he reads out the band number, and it's Igor. Igor has made it all the way back from South Carolina to Niagara Falls, and obviously he wasn't part of the biker dinner, so we were elated. Obviously one bird was, he was 70 miles off course, but he'd made it back that far, so we decided we'll go down and pick him up. But before we could leave, 29 other geese came in and landed all around us. And they made it back the next year, of the great majority of them. So they hadn't been eaten by bikers as the story had gone around. And we were elated. And of course, there was a big party. And we fed them the best corn possible. And Igor's forgotten for the day. So the next day, we decided, well, go and get Igor, because he's obviously lost. And before we could even leave again, four more geese fly in, and it's Igor, and he's got three wild females with him. So that's the true story of Igor, not the Hollywood version, as you might have seen in Fly Away Home. And Fly Away Home was great fun. I double for Jeff Daniels, who plays me in the film, and so I get the fun. I do the flying, and riding the motorcycles and all the various things that Jeff Daniels does, because you know movie actors are precious. They don't want them taking chances, and I'm happy to do that. Some of the shots from Fly Away Home, but the thing that really always got back to me was that we are going through a major mass extinction on the planet, the biggest mass extinction of species since the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. And actually, this little statement here about the number of species, so something like 50,000 species went extinct last year alone. And so, of course, the whooping crane was the poster child of species endangered, and so both Joe and I thought, well, that's what we should concentrate on. And over the next few years, we did. The whooping crane, of course, migrates from way up in the north of Canada down to the Texas Gulf Coast. And in 1940, there were only 16 of them left, and by the 50s, there were something like 50. And the whooping crane recovery team, which are made up of biologists from both Canada and the U.S., decided the thing that would save them is to create a secondary flock somewhere. And they had been trying for years to figure out how to do that. So they were willing at a certain point. They were kind of desperate because there was nothing that had worked. Maybe these guys with ultralights could do it. So we did a number of experiments with sandhill cranes over the next few years, from 97 to 99, with three migrations of sandhill cranes, and had wear these costumes, because if you're going to work with endangered species, you've got to keep them wild. These were the first costumes with sandhill cranes, and that worked. We did fly them around Lake Ontario because they don't fly over large bodies of water. Great wonders to fly with, and I'm going to go over this fairly quickly because tomorrow morning at 11:30, I believe one of the Operation Migration team are going to speak in the museum theater, one of the museum theaters, on this whole project, and really give you probably more details on it. I'm not involved with it anymore, so. But this gives you a little idea of what we did with sandhill cranes. We flew them around Lake Ontario. This is a really interesting thing to me, because the common belief was that birds learn the migration route by memorizing the geography. So if we flew them this way, they don't fly across large bodies of water either. So we flew them around Lake Ontario, and we thought that they would follow that back. Well, here's what they did. This was the route they took back. And so they have their own built-in GPS. They know how to get back to where they came from, and we can't figure out really how they do it. And how we knew where they were, because the radios that tracked them had failed, we'd made a little mistake in our imprinting, and the pen we raised them in looked kind of like a schoolyard, and they landed in schoolyards all the way back. So we'd get a call from a principal who'd read the number on their tag and said, you know, there's six big birds out here trying to play soccer with our kids. And those birds ranged all over Ontario. A lot more funny stories that summer with those cranes, because they got bolder and landed in various places. Two of them landed in the city of Peterborough, Ontario, on the main street on a Saturday afternoon, and somebody in a bar with some nuts and enticed them into the bar, and we had to go and get them out of the bar. And the final thing was that they landed in medium security prison, and they wouldn't leave because the prisoners just loved them, and you know, chain link fence again, and we had to go and bust them out. But anyway, we did learn a lot from these sandhill cranes, and built the pens differently, and then the recovery team had decided that the best route would be to fly them from Wisconsin to Florida. They'd done a number of studies on that, and in 2000, we flew a flock of sandhill cranes from Wisconsin all the way to Florida. It was a historic flight, 1,200 miles, the longest migration that we'd ever done, and it really did work. This is a shot somewhere over southern Illinois, or more like Indiana, I should say. And then by 2001, because that was successful, 10 of those 11 sandhill cranes came right back to Nisida out here in Wisconsin. And this bird was the first whooping crane hatched in 2001 that was going to fly south. And so a historic bird. And this is kind of a one-minute video of what happens. Can you all see that? These birds are actually now hatched in Patuxent, Maryland. And then once they get to be flying age, and they're raised very carefully, the imprinting protocols are very special. They don't run over them anymore with this. Somebody developed this circle cage so that the birds become acclimatized to the aircraft, conditioned to the aircraft, essentially. And when they get to be flying age, then they'll fly with it. And the costumes, they never hear a human voice, and they never see a human on the ground during their whole raising period. The whole imprinting period. And by fall, they're flying with us, and we take them south, or the now Operation Migration does. So it has worked, and these are some of the images very quickly of that migration. As I say, a lot more detail probably tomorrow in that presentation by Operation Migration. It's become quite an operation involving a number of pilots and taking months to do. Wonderful birds to fly with, though. And a wonderful way to see the USA, to fly south with a change of the color, to see every state, like going across. That's Indianapolis off there in the distance. And of course, landing, wearing these suits looks kind of funny in a lot of places. And across the Ohio and into Kentucky and across Tennessee. And Crossing the Appalachians with them is always the scary bit. The route has changed now, and here this is a little bit of footage to show you what happens with this when these birds catch the wave. This from a wingtip camera, the bird catches the wave and just cruises off the wingtip there. Almost a free ride for them. And when we land in Georgia, this couple has often come out and help us put up. And that's Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. They're quite ardent birders. What you don't see in behind the picture, this is a picture in 2002, I believe. And what you don't see in the bushes behind them are five Secret Service agents there. And that's the team in 2002. As I say, I've retired from that now, but in 2009, there are 82 whooping cranes that are migrating in eastern North America. And really, it is the most successful reintroduction of an endangered species in North America. As John Christian from the Fish and Wildlife Service said, it's the equivalent of putting a man on the moon, the wildlife equivalent of putting a man on the moon. So I want to move on quickly to my next thing, which I call air first aid. It's a system to provide, immediate relief, and also maybe a worldwide network of conservationists that are flying weight shift aircraft. This is conceptually how it might work. This is a little animation done by my son Jordy, and a C-130 might land and disgorge all of these things near a disaster zone, at an airstrip near a disaster zone, and then the aircraft can be assembled and ready to fly inside of 2 hours. Trained pilots could fly these and carry a pod underneath about 200 pounds of materials, like just the essentials that people need on that very first thing after a disaster has gone through. It could be water, it could be shelter, and there are any number of things it could carry. And they, of course, with the 100 horsepower weight shift aircraft today, they get off the ground very quickly, and this is the thing that would make it work. They don't have to land. They could just do a low and over and drop that. So over the last few years, I've been working with a engineer from Paul Yarnell, another ultralight pioneer from New York State, and Paul and I, with the help of Northwing from Washington State, Northwing, we build very fine weight shift aircraft. We modified one of those north wings to carry the pod, and this is the first shot at takeoff. It's not a fully loaded pod, of course, and it's not the full power engine, but this is just to make sure it works. We did this is the very first drop. You just come in like you're going to do a landing, and then do a low and over, and it actually we use the brake pedal as the release, and it worked. It works. It's gaining momentum around the world. There's a number of people that are truly interested in it, but it's taking a long time, longer than I like, but it's working. And there's an NGO by the name of Shelterbox that is supported by Rotary International, and they do a similar thing, only they lug it by land, and they're very interested in working with us. So it is taking off, and I believe that within a few years we'll have a network of pilots around the world that are flying weight shift aircraft, and when there is a disaster zone that you can't get helicopters too quickly or you can't get supplies in, that this will work. As I say, there's 6 billion of us on the planet, and we're headed for 7 billion, and climate change is for real. Whether it's man-made or not is debatable, but essentially it's causing all kinds of disasters, and there are going to be more and more. And this, if this can at least alleviate some forms of suffering and pain, that would be really great. And I'd love to see that as my swan song, so to speak. But we really do owe it to the birds, because they pointed the sky out to us and gave us that inspiration to get up there and get that three-dimensional freedom. And as we look around Air Venture here and see the wondrous things that aviation has brought us, the myriad of absolute fantastic creations that fly, it is the birds that inspired us. And I don't need to say any more than that. When you think about what Denny said, it's, if you've got the idea and you want to do something, you got to go for it and you got to follow your dreams. That's what I've done, and I hope my last dream here, Air First Aid, will work. And if any of you know any way to help me move that along, I'd be happy to hear from you. And last slide here shows you, that early imprinting does work, by the way. That young girl now has got her master's degree in biology and works with birds all over the world. And any of these things, if you, aviationspeakers.com, if any of you need speakers like you've heard here tonight, operationmigration.org to follow the migration. And if you want to have a look at any more of my sculpture, for sure, williamlishman.com, and Air First Aid, all those four websites. Thank you.